Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And goose foot you find in people's lawns everywhere. And you just saute it in a little bit of olive oil, and it's like spinach. It's even more delicate than spinach.
Dee Dee Emmons loves eating and cooking wild greens, those plants some people might call weeds. We chat with her about some of her favorite recipes that incorporate wild edibles. Our look at solar panels across southern Indiana continues with a visit to the Harmony School. Students combined science and art in the school's new solar sculpture that will generate power to run the greenhouse. In the kitchen, Chef Daniel Orr fixes a strawberry shortcake and a breakfast frittata. And we meet some five-day-old Sicilian buttercup chicks on Jana Wilson's farm. Lots happening today on Earth Eats. Bringing us the food news headlines for the week is Luann Johnson.
Annie, last week we reported on a new caffeinated gum by Wrigley's. Each piece of Alert Energy gum contains a half cup of coffee's worth of caffeine. This week, Wrigley's announced it would take the gum off the market temporarily as the Food and Drug Administration investigates the safety of added caffeine. After meeting with FDA officials, the North American president of Wrigley's, Casey Keller, says the company has, quote, a greater appreciation for its concern about the proliferation of caffeine in the nation's food supply. Farmers who begged for rain during last year's drought have finally got what they asked for. By the bucket. The ground throughout the plains and the Midwest is so waterlogged that farmers have been forced to delay their corn planting for this year. The USDA reports that only 12% of the country's cornfields have been planted. That's 75% less than the amount planted in the previous 5 years. In Iowa, the country's biggest corn-producing state, only 8% of fields have been sowed, down from 62% at this time last year. During rainy seasons, farmers must balance the risks of planting in wet fields against the risks of planting too late in the year. Taking farm machinery onto wet fields compacts the soil, which makes it difficult for seeds to develop a strong root system. Waiting for the soil to dry out, however, can cut the growing season short. Non-commodity farmers are feeling the pinch as well. In a newsletter to CSA members, Teresa Bertels of Heartland Family Farm says it's been so cold and rainy that, quote, many of the field veggies are just sitting there waiting for some consecutive days of sunshine and warm temps. And in an effort to figure out what's behind colony collapse disorder, scientists have developed a new hypothesis. High fructose corn syrup fed to bees could be partly to blame. Commercial bees are often fed high fructose corn syrup in place of honey in their hives, a practice that started in the 1970s when research deemed it safe. But it isn't the high fructose corn syrup itself that's harming bees. Rather, the bees are thought to miss out on immunity enhancements conferred by natural honey when given the artificial substitute. A group of researchers from the University of Illinois found that when bees are exposed to a particular enzyme found in honey, their immune system becomes stronger. Read more about these stories on our website, eartheats.org, and follow us on Twitter and Facebook to get news updates like this throughout the week. Find us by searching for Earth Eats.
This week we bid a fond farewell to one of our news bloggers, Sarah Gordon. Thanks for all the hard work these past couple years, Sarah, and we all wish you good luck. Luann Johnson, thank you for bringing us the news headlines.
It's my pleasure, Annie.
In the past couple weeks, we've spoken with two farmers who've installed solar panels to make their farms more green. A local school is also getting in on the action. Harmony School's pinwheel-shaped solar sculpture is the first of its kind in Bloomington, Indiana. Thanks to a grant secured by teacher Emily Sprowls, the students were able to design the sculpture and help it get erected. The energy generated from the panels is minimal, just enough to run lights and heater cables in the school's greenhouse. But energy self-sufficiency was never the point of the project anyway. It's May Day at the Harmony School. The students are enjoying warm and sunny weather on the school's green space as the Morris dancers teach the Maypole dance. Wes Biddle is a Harmony School alum and the owner of Atomic Electric. He's standing on a ladder putting the finishing touches on the wiring of the school's solar sculpture.
And we're just about to bring the system online. We'll be making power. So we're celebrating not just May Day today, but two other things.
My name is Emily Sprowls, and I am the high school science teacher at Harmony School.
The solar sculpture was Sprowls' brainchild. She began working on the idea with students in her energy class in 2011. Then, last summer, she secured a $10,000 grant through the Audubon Society, funded by Toyota. With additional support from the Bloomington Area Arts Commission, she was able to provide a hands-on experience for the students.
I've taught this class before when we haven't had the money to build something, and it's all been a little bit, you know, just academic, like how does it work and going to see places. But these guys have been involved in the nitty-gritty of what do we need to think about as we change the shape of these panels? How many watts do we need? How much can we spend to invert from DC to AC? All of those pieces became a lot more real.
That's the solar panel installation out there.
Ryan Brademeyer and James Scallon are ninth graders in Sproul's energy class.
Initially, we were hoping to have a design like a camera aperture.
It started out with a wider circle in the middle.
But due to structural concerns and space concerns, we decided to condense it. So we have, it almost looks like a flower.
Which ultimately still worked out and is still pretty awesome.
It's a flower or a pinwheel sort of design made up of 8 triangular solar panels, which generate about 700 watts. The students collaborated on the design, and Biddle and Alex Jarvis of Solar Systems of Indiana helped adapt it into a workable structure.
Being that it's an art piece and it's a kind of demonstration piece, the kids felt like it was a better value to have less wattage and a little bit more artistic design.
For, 600, 700 watts, you could power like a computer, many, many laptops, lighting.
About 10 light bulbs.
Long before the ground was broken on the solar sculpture, the students conducted an audit of the school's energy usage. They measured each appliance with kilowatt meters. What they discovered is that small appliances in standby mode were the primary culprits in the school's energy use. Think about the little red light that stays on even when your TV is turned off but not unplugged. 11th grader Jessica Smith says this exercise has changed how she consumes energy.
When I would think about like electricity, I always saw it in a saving money aspect. I never really thought about it as like saving our planet. And so like it's really cool to tie that in.
While the students can change their personal habits, the school as a whole is unlikely to undergo a massive energy consumption overhaul. That's partially due to the fact that, according to school director Steve Bonchek, this is the oldest school building in the state of Indiana still being used as a school. Nevertheless, he applauds the students' research.
Environmental stewardship and ecological literacy is one of our core principles here, so we really want the kids to feel a sense of responsibility for leaving things better than they found them.
Another one of Harmony School's core principles is creating community, which Brademeyer says was as important to this project as designing and building the solar sculpture.
And I also just like volunteering for the school. It's part of, in a way, it's kind of part of the culture, both at the school and in Bloomington.
Check out photos of the solar sculpture on our website, eartheats.org. Peter Del Tredici, scientist at Harvard University, has said, quote, "I consider weed to be a politically incorrect term. There's no biological definition of the term weed. It's really a value judgment," unquote. Chef Dee Dee Emmons couldn't agree more. Her cookbook, Wild Flavors, celebrates her relationship with a local New England farmer, Eva Samaripa, whom she credits for introducing her to all sorts of feisty, flavorful, and nutritious plants.
For instance, I had a quinoa salad today for lunch, and I threw raisins and walnuts and a bunch of cilantro, and I just used that, and I didn't need any salad dressing, but it took me about 4 or 5 years before I started to like chickweed. But once you mix it in with a little bit of, say, cilantro and sorrel and a little lettuce, and you make a salad of it, it's like adding a little bit of vinegar to a soup. You know, you don't like vinegar straight up, but once it's added to the soup, it brings out all the flavors.
Some plants don't need much at all. They're pretty tasty, eaten straight from the ground.
An example of that would be wood sorrel, oxalis, which is a tiny little plant or weed. And it tastes almost a little sweet, and you find that everywhere. And goosefoot, you find in people's lawns everywhere. And you just saute it in a little bit of olive oil, and it's like spinach. It's even more delicate than spinach.
When I'm looking here at the goosefoot pancakes.
Do
you remember this recipe? Can you talk me through this?
It's almost like a crepe. And these are things that you can just eat as a snack, or you can make fancy hors d'oeuvres and top it with a little sour cream, a little dollop of creme fraiche or goat cheese. But you chop the greens up and you add it to the pancake batter, and they're bright green, and they're just tasty. I mean, I first tried them with 1 cup of greens, and then I think I ended up going up to 4 cups, and it just kept getting better.
You know, I was just flipping through this. There are a lot of dessert-y type recipes using greens, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think that chefs now are seeing the value of herbs that are quite savory, meaning they're not sweet at all. So herbs like oregano or basil or rosemary, and they'll use them with sweet treatments. So I have a shortbread recipe, you know, which is like a butter cookie, and I use juniper berries in them. But rosemary would be equally good, or lavender would be equally good. I put a bunch of sorbets in the book. There's a calamint sorbet. Calamint is an herb that's this cross between oregano and mint. And there's something about mixing sugar with these very earthy flavors that makes for this wonderful dessert.
Read the complete interview with Chef Dee Dee Emmons on our website, eartheats.org. And if you try making that calamint sorbet, write a comment to let us know how it tastes. Coming up.
If you put them on newspaper, their legs can slip and they can actually pull a tendon and get something that's called straddle leg. So we start them off on towels and it's warmer.
That's chicken farmer Jana Wilson. Early spring means chicks, lots and lots of chicks. She introduces us to some of her 5-day-old Sicilian buttercups. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors of everything from cookbooks to food history books. This week, we chatted with Anna Blessing, whose new book, Locally Grown, celebrates the relationships Chicago restaurants have with their area farms that provide their food.
A regular shopper at farmers markets, Blessings says she wanted to tell the stories of small artisanal producers. After a little research, she found out she wasn't the only one.
I started talking to chefs in Chicago, and those chefs, they wouldn't stop talking about those farmers because they got so excited about them, and they wanted to tell their stories, and they wanted to tell every last detail of how they grow their food and what they learned when they went to their farm. And I just realized that it is a very contagious subject.
Here's 1 minute with author Anna Blessing.
I mean, you would actually be amazed at how many of these chefs have been to all of their farms that they source from. They're bringing along their whole kitchen crew, you know, see what it's like to eat a watermelon grown right there and just cracked open and eaten fresh as it could ever be. So I think that chefs, it's not just that they want to source locally. The ones who are really, really committed to it, they really want to know their farmers and they want to have these relationships with them. And, you know, it's such a two-way relationship. It's not just as simple as the chef's buying food from the farmer. It's much more about a collaborative relationship. So the farmer's asking the chef, what do you want me to grow? What amazing, you know, different varieties could I grow for you that I could try out? And the chef is planning menus around what the farmers are growing or what is in season in their region that, you know, moment in time. And that's what you start to see in these collaborations where Peter Klein at Seedling, he did a collaboration with Carrie Nahabedian at Naha in Chicago, where he grew pears in bottles so that she could then bottle her own pear liqueurs, and so it becomes just kind of one more way to just be so creative in what they're already doing.
Perfect. Thank you, Anna. This has been awesome.
Thank you so much, Annie.
Have a good one.
Bye.
Bye. Read more about Anna Blessing's new book, Locally Grown, on our website, eartheats.org.
The two black ones under the bush are black australorps.
But they're very placid as well. They lay brown eggs, and the Buff Orpington lays brown eggs. Oh, here's a fun fact.
Jana Wilson is our resident chicken farmer. She's been raising mostly Sicilian buttercups for about 13 years.
So here, the fun fact is, if you look at a bird, you saw the earlobes of the buttercups. They're white. If you look at the earlobes of a bird, if they have white earlobes, they lay white eggs. And if they have red earlobes like they have, then they lay brown eggs.
Really?
Uh-huh. So you can tell what color an egg a bird is going to lay by the color of their earlobes.
What about the blue eggs?
Well, now that is different. Those are Americanas, and I actually have one. And one of the black ones over there is an Americana. I have a couple that lay the green and blue eggs. Their earlobes are red, so they're different. And you can't tell from them, but they're the exception. Okay. They are the exception.
There are somewhere around 30 chickens and several ducks roaming around her land just outside Bloomington. But this time of year, that number quadruples thanks to all the chicks she's just hatched. She started hatching in April, which is 2 months later than she normally likes to start. On a typical year, she'll have 100 little chicks to take care of. Usually, she keeps 5 to 10 birds for her farm, and she sells the remainders at poultry shows across the Midwest. She shows me inside her shed, which is home to a bunch of little fluff balls.
Oh, and these guys are 2 weeks old.
How cute.
And when they're little, they can't... Their feathers provide the heat and warmth. And when they have the down, they can't keep warmth in their body. So that's why you have to... When you bring a chick home, you know, from the hatchery or when the chicks are first born, the first week they have to have 95 degrees. It has to be 95 degrees. And then the next week, 90, and you go down 5 degrees every week until you hit about 70. And by then, they should have feathers.
I know. Okay, the perch is over.
Whatever. All right. Okay, we're going to go upstairs, and I will show you the babies. They're so cute.
The 5-day-old buttercup chicks live upstairs in her house. Their cage is covered in a towel, and a heat lamp keeps everything really warm.
Oh, my goodness.
Look how teeny tiny.
Oh. God, they spill their food all over the place.
I start the baby chicks off on, like, towels, and that's so their feet can grip. If you put them on newspaper, their legs can slip, and they can actually pull a tendon and get something that's called straddle legs. So we start them off on towels, and it's warmer.
See, I have my little thermometer in there so I can kind of keep an eye on the temperature.
The most fetching thing is on their heads, they have just like a black pattern. It's almost looks a little paisley. I've never seen chicks like that before.
They are unusual. Some people call it the chipmunk markings. I don't know. They do look a little bit like chipmunks, I guess. But yeah, that's kind of a unique feather patterning for the buttercups. You don't really see... I think they look like little bandits. Don't they look like they have little masks on?
They do, yeah. Their eyes are outlined in black as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's something unique to buttercup chicks. So
adorable.
They're cute, aren't they?
I'm so glad we came up here. Using some local strawberries in this first recipe, an old favorite also makes an appearance, Chef Daniel Orr's legendary buttermilk biscuits.
You know, you can use it for so many things. We've used it for biscuit biscotti. We've used it, you know, served with goat cheese, make them with Parmesan. You could throw some wild garlic chives in the biscuit mix, and, you know, there are lots of ways to use it. But today we're going to make it into a dessert to celebrate spring strawberries. So I've got a nice dish of strawberries, probably about... 3 to 4 cups of strawberries. I'm going to put a little bit of local maple syrup. This comes from Burton's Maple Camp. Probably about 1/2 to 3/4 cup of maple syrup.
What grade maple syrup are you using?
Well, this I like to use the grade B. Grade B is, I think, a little gutsier. Grade A is for pancakes, you know, where you're really going to taste the maple syrup without a lot of other confusing elements. But when you start adding other things like, you know, the sweet acidity of strawberries, it would distract from grade A syrup. So use grade B for those things. I'm going to add about 1/2 lemon's worth of juice. Now, again, with desserts, a lot of times I'll add a pinch of salt and just a little pinch of freshly ground black pepper.
For a little something different, we're adding some fresh mint to this dish.
These are really perfumey. You know, they've been waiting underground all winter long. They're going to the disco when they come out. And when it's this young, you can even throw some of the stems in. It doesn't matter. They're tender. It's only when, you know, mint gets older and gets woody that you really need to worry about the stems. Kind of sprinkle that over the strawberries. We're going to toss this. Now, you can let this macerate for 10 or 15 minutes, and that's when you put fruit and sugar together and it draws out the liquid. So, you know, anytime you cut up some fruit and you toss it with sugar, it'll turn into a syrup, and that's maceration. All right, so I've got these nice biscuits. They're warm from the oven. I'm going to just put a little bit of strawberries on because I want to top these with ice cream, and if I put the ice cream directly on the biscuit, it would melt too quickly. And then what I like to do is to take a little bit of yogurt, and that's going to cut down on the sweetness of the ice cream, and I just kind of drizzle that around the outside, and then decorate it with some more of those mint babies. Okay, and that's mint and maple strawberry shortcake.
See photos, watch a video, and print off the recipe on our website. It's basically everything but the taste at eartheats.org. And we'll finish today with a breakfast recipe. This frittata has squash blossoms in it. So first things first, gotta pick the flowers.
Now this is my compost, and these plants just grew out of the compost. So I've got all these crazy squash plants growing. And these you have to pick every day. They will keep several days in the refrigerator, but if you left them on the plant, they would wilt by the end of the day. So if you just have a couple plants and you don't have enough for a whole meal, you can pick them every day for a few days, and then you'll have enough for the weekend.
Do you remember composting squash? You suppose that's why these are growing?
Yes, absolutely. We take all the seeds out and throw the seeds in the compost bucket at the restaurant, and then I bring them home, and then I cover the whole compost with fall leaves, and then the next year, all kinds of stuff grows out
of
there.
Who knows? It's like a surprise garden. That's fun.
And you can see these have gone all the way up in the tree, and it's like a forest of squash flowers. All right, so we can head in and cook up some breakfast.
And a frittata is basically the easiest omelet you can make because you don't have to worry about flipping it or turning it over. You serve it right in the pan. What we've done is we've already parboiled some other little fingerling potatoes. So we're going to get those started in the pan. You can just grab me the olive oil there.
Absolutely.
We're going to let those get started. I'll crack some eggs. We'll just give those a little whisk. So this is a great dish to do on the weekends when you have some friends over for brunch. You can just crack the eggs, throw them on top of your sautéed vegetables. You could use anything really that you have in your refrigerator. Throw a little bit of cheese on there, and then pop it in the oven until it's set, and that's all there is to it. And I'm going to add a little bit of chopped garlic. So we want to cook this just until the garlic starts to brown a little bit. In the meantime, I'm going to just make sure we don't have any critters left in the squash flowers, because sometimes they hide out inside.
Well, that's protein, though, right?
Yeah. And you can leave the stems and everything right on there. All right. We're going to add our eggs, a little bit of salt and pepper. Got a little of my au poivre blend, a little bit of Mediterranean blend, which is just kind of like an herbe de Provence.
I would imagine the spice blend sort of makes this dish. Talk me through what's in both of those.
All right, well, the Mediterranean blend is, like I said, it's like an herbe de Provence, so there's thyme and savory and a little bit of lavender, basil, a little bit of oregano, so a nice little mix of spices. And then the au poivre is just a mixture of different peppers. So I have a little bit of crushed red pepper, a little coriander seed, some black pepper, white pepper, guinea pepper, so a lot of different flavors there. All right, now we're just going to push in the edges, just like you would an omelet. Make sure we have our potatoes evenly dispersed. I'm going to turn off the heat, and we're going to pop that in the oven with a little bit of cheese on top.
Frittata time. Let's see. Is it ready to go?
It is.
Oh, that's beautiful.
Nice, firm setup.
Pulling away from the edges a little bit?
Just a little bit around the edge, right? We'll put it over here, and I'll cut it into wedges, just like you would do a quiche. And if you wanted to, you could serve a little bit of red pepper sauce or tomato sauce with this. Just really whatever you want. It makes a perfect peasant's dish. All right. Who wants a taste?
Lots of recipes, photos, interviews, news articles, all on our website. Come check us out at eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Aabon Binder, Anna Blessing, Dee Dee Emmons, Sarah Gordon, Luann Johnson, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Jana Wilson, and everyone at the Harmony School. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for tuning in today. Till next week, happy eating. I'm Annie Corrigan.